Good afternoon and welcome to Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Tom Lounges and this is Midwest Beat, a program all about music, the arts, the people behind it, and the people who make it. Coming up on the second half of the show around 1 o'clock, we'll be welcoming in from Los Angeles, California, and Las Vegas, the Stoney Curtis Band. They're in town to perform at Leroy's Hot Stuff this weekend. We'll have them in here talking about their original music, their psychedelic blues sound, and some of the great stuff they've accomplished. They'll be live in studio, but the first hour, we're going to jazz it up. You see, there's a brand new DVD documentary being released in September, and it's being released by Eagle Vision. It's called Blue Note Records, Beyond the Notes. And we'll be joined by the director, Swiss filmmaker Sophie Huber, in just a bit. But first, let's take it on a maiden voyage, going back to the 1960s with Herbie Hancock from his first album for Blue Note Records. We'll be back with Sophie after this. Stay with us. Lots of jazz coming up.
Thank you.
taking you back to the mid-1960s, giving you a little bit of the first album from the great Herbie Hancock. That is the title track, Maiden Voyage, one of many amazing artists that came to the world through Blue Note Records. Today we're talking with film director Sophie Huber, calling in from Switzerland, which of course is the home of the Montreux Jazz Festival. And Sophie is the director of this great film that has just come out, or is coming out rather, in September 6th, in about a week, called Blue Note Records, Behind the Notes. And it is a great documentary. I've been privy to looking at it in advance, watching it. And Sophie, welcome to Midwest Beat.
Thank you so much, Tom.
How did
to, I'm really grateful you take the time to, you know, feature the film.
I am a big jazz fan going back years and years and years. I discovered Miles Davis and Charlie Parker and all those guys, and I was working in jazz radio and R&B radio many, many years ago as a young man. And to me, the music is timeless, and I think it's wonderful that you are bringing this sound and these vintage songs and the history of one of the most impacting labels of all time to a new generation. And it carries over well because Don Was Not Was, also a famous rock producer, is now the president of Blue Note, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Because he's featured in the documentary, which gives it a very contemporary feel. And, of course, the new kids on the block back then, like Herbie Hancock, who signed in 62 and gave us that album, I think it was 64 or 65. He's a commentator on this, as is Wayne Shorter and some of the younger fellas, as we like to call them back in the day. But you also cover John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk and Miles Davis and all these wonderful pioneers of the sound. How did you get involved in this? Where's the root of Blue Note Records, Beyond the Notes? Where did this start?
I made a documentary about Harry Dean Stanton, the actor, who you might know his face better than his name.
Yeah, he's one of the
in about 200 films, you know, and played the one, like the only lead in Paris, Texas, for instance.
He's a great character actor. I do remember that documentary.
Yeah, and you know, he didn't want to talk or, you know, reveal himself in any other way than through songs. So it became a music film. And I was looking for a record label to put out a soundtrack. And a friend of mine introduced me to Don Was, who had just become the president of Blue Note. And he actually ended up playing bass on a couple of tracks.
Wow.
He's an amazing bass player. But it came out elsewhere, you know, it didn't fit into the Blue Note catalog, but he really loved the film. And we were talking about other films, like I wanted to do a documentary about Kris Kristofferson, you know, and other musicians. And one thing led to the next, and he asked if I'd be interested in doing something on Blue Note. And of course, I was, you know, I had known about the label since I was a kid. My father had those records. And as you mentioned, you know, Switzerland has a amazing jazz festival. It's not only the Montreux Jazz Festival, but even in my hometown of Bern, you know, I heard Dizzy Gillespie and Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald at an early age. My sister happened to be an usher at the jazz festival.
Mm.
So she would let me in. And so there was just sort of a basic, very basic, you know, knowledge and great appreciation for the music. And I then went, you know, I wanted to make sure it's an independent film and not like a promotional piece for Blue Note.
Right.
And it's financed through public funds in Switzerland. And the BBC. So, and then, you know, we tried to get money in America, but nobody, the Americans don't seem to appreciate their own art form that much.
That is a travesty that has been a case here for years, even going back to the blues. If you look at the blues history, how we had to basically absorb it back from England as it was interpreted by the Stones and the Animals and the Zombies. We didn't appreciate our own artists, our Muddy Waters, our Howlin' Wolves, our B.B. Kings, until they came back and said, look, this is cool music because we're trendy. And, you know, it's the same thing with jazz. We don't appreciate what is inherently ours. Dixieland, example. I mean, just great musics that nobody pays attention to.
Yeah.
But thanks to documentaries like yours and your efforts, I mean, I think we are going to reach a younger generation. And one of the things that really jumped out at me about this, that screams contemporary, is the way you trace the lineage of the music from an artist like Thelonious Monk to modern hip-hop. You've got hip-hop directors, producers, artists in this documentary talking about how they were influenced, how hip-hop was born in many ways out of the music of artists like Thelonious Monk or John Coltrane.
Yeah, that was really important to me. You know, when I started researching and trying to figure out how do I put 8 years of history into 90 minutes? Because it was clear that, you know, if you get public funds here, it has to be a theatrical format. So right. It can't be a TV miniseries or something like that, which you could, you know, obviously easily do with a subject like Blue Note.
Right.
So what I try to figure out is how can I condense this story into 90 minutes. And one of the things that was clear was I wanted to tell it through the musicians whenever possible, so that they would talk about the music and talk about their influences, so that automatically creates that, that tradition in jazz where one generation learns from the next,
mm-hmm.
and how they also support each other, you know, through different generations, which is really, you know, I find very beautiful to see. And to feature also what's happening today. There's always been movements in this music and changes and breaking the rules. So the connection to hip hop, not only through sampling, but also people, you know, like Robert Glasper and Ambrose Akinmuziri, the younger musicians in the film, play on Kendrick Lamar's records,
mm-hmm.
And others, of course, but that's the one I chose for the film.
The history of the label itself intrigued me. I didn't know a lot about the formation of the label or really about Alfred Lion or Francis Wolfe. And I think it's interesting the way the artists themselves would talk about how they had this brotherhood, this companionship with these guys. And for the listeners, they were two jazz-loving German immigrants who escaped Nazism in the late 30s, I believe it was, to find a new life in America. And they came from persecution. They had their civil rights stepped on by the Nazis. They were in danger of all kinds of things. They came to America and saw the same thing happen with African Americans. And it seemed like there was a kinship there. And the love of the music blended the colors together. It wasn't a color thing at all. It was about the music. And I thought the way you put that out there, the way the artists spoke of Alfred and Francis, about the clips you had of their interviews, I thought that really underscored the unity of how music is healing and how jazz especially can unite people. I thought that was a beautiful understory, if you will.
Yeah, that was also a reason where, you know, once I started researching more to focus on the humanity in the music and the people who created this platform for the music and for the musicians to support him to do whatever they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And just that respect and to do something for the arts and for the importance of the arts that is often, again, you know, underappreciated. Who were not concerned with business first or, you know, financial success first. but with the, as you know, Wayne Shorter says, we wanted to create value. A value that, like, what would people, what would it do to the world? What would people, would they still listen to it in 20 years? And now, you know, it's more than that, and people still listen to it.
Right.
And when I just heard Maiden Voyage that you played, I mean, it's just timeless. It just puts you in a different space.
50 some years later, and it's still as impacting today as it was when it came out. That's just, yeah. That's amazing. Speaking of Wayne Shorter, let's play a little clip from one of his early recordings for Blue Note. This is Wildflower. We'll be back with Sophie Huber and talk more Blue Note notes after this. What a great song, what a great player. Wayne Shorter, Wildflower, cutting it a little bit short because we have such an amazing guest with us today. We're just going to be doing little segments of songs. Sophie Huber is with us, calling in from Switzerland. She is the filmmaker that has given us Blue Note Records' Behind the Notes. It's coming out on DVD, Blu-ray, and digital format September 6th of this, next month, next week. It did have a theatrical run. I don't remember seeing it in theaters here.
Well, I hope it will get into a Chicago theater. We're still working on that.
There's a few art house theaters, you know, that might pick it up, Music Box, things like that. But I would have thought that by now you've already won the German Documentary Award for Best Music Film. I would think that Chicago, a city like this that has jazz clubs and has a jazz and a blues scene, would have jumped on screening this.
Yeah, I still hope we can make it happen. Because it's such I think it's important to see the film on the big screen whenever, you know, if you can, just to experience the power of the music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to sit in a space that's just dedicated to that and to hear the full, you know, 5-1 mix I hope we'll make it happen. It's also Herbie Hancock's it's where he comes from.
Okay. September 6th, it comes out courtesy of Eagle Vision, Eagle Vision does a lot of different styles of music, but jazz is not what they're known for. They're more of a rock distributor. Was it a hard sell to get them to pick this up?
Well, one of the first things that was mentioned in a meeting was, how do we avoid the J word?
Ah.
But they came around and actually they're releasing a couple of jazz documentaries now.
Okay, so it's not a bad word now.
No, not anymore.
So if I understood correct, Don was kind of threw the seed at you. You ran with it, and now we have this beautiful film, 90 minutes of history and art merging. How long was the process from the time Don says, well, why not do something on Blue Note, and you saying yes to actually getting it done and screened for the first time? How long of your life did you dedicate to this?
Well, up to now, it will be 5 years in the fall.
Holy cow.
But it premiered in Tribeca last year. So the film was basically finished then.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a very long time to finance it, then to edit it, you know, because it's so complex and again, like how do you put all this material into a format that's also digestible for people who are not necessarily jazz aficionados or even like the music very much, because
mm-hmm.
that was something that was really important to me to help change that, because I think there's a lot of sort of misconceptions that you need to know jazz to understand it, or you know, it needs to be an intellectual experience or something, which I just don't think is the case at all, you know. It was also important to figure out how to attract a younger audience and to make it work for kids, you know, to find out who their amazing heroes are.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of digressed. What was your question?
Basically, how long it took you to put all this together? And said 5 years. I mean, that is quite a journey.
So what I meant to say was, after it premiered at Tribeca in April of last year, it took a really long time again to find theatrical distribution in the US. It came out in, you know, Switzerland and the UK and Ireland and Canada. But I just wanted to make sure it comes out in the States.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't picked up by any of the bigger distributors. So wow. I basically had to do this on my own. And, you know, find a theater in New York, Metrograph, who did the first run, and then other theaters came on board. But that's why it took sort of an extra year.
Okay.
And a half now, you know.
You have footage that goes back, it seems like, to the late 30s, early 40s at least. Where were these slabs of footage archived that you were able to access them? And they still look very, you know, very powerful, very clear, even though they're old clips. There's a little bit of grain here and there, but it gives the historical perspective. But, I mean, it's the quality overall. Was there a lot of digitizing? Where was this archival footage kept all these years, and how accessible was it to you as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff looks so great also because it was shot on film, and that just has a different feel to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of research first just on YouTube, but then there's archival houses who have those masters and then cleaned them up, you know. One that was not so great, but there was nothing we could do, was the Clifford Brown footage, but that's the only footage that exists of him.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a lot of research and... Then, of course, we had the photographs that we had access to through Michael Kuskuna, who's in the film and who owns the entire archive of Francis Wolfe, who's one of the founders, but also photographed almost every session.
And I think we were blessed by the fact that Francis was a camera buff, because they were talking how, like, all the different sessions, he'd pop in with his camera and just archive things just for himself. And fortunately, all that film made it into the archives and was saved.
And they're so beautiful, these photographs.
They're brilliant.
Yeah.
It's beautiful black and white photos, shot on film. So the archives, are they still owned by Blue Note, or are they outside? I didn't quite understand how much Blue Note was involved as far as the ownership of the stuff you present. It's historical, but a lot of stuff like here is kept in the Smithsonian of different labels. Is there something like that in Europe where some of this stuff was archived outside of Blue Note?
Well, I mean, you know, the concert footage that you see in the film has nothing to do with Blue Note, because they didn't really, except for later, you know, when it's a Norah Jones video that belongs to them. But all, you know, like Monk, Coltrane, Miles Davis, these are have nothing to do with Blue Note, because they didn't film those concerts. So, and the photographs, are Michael Kuskuna, so they're not really directly in Blue Note possession either.
Okay.
And the music, which is we cleared, you know, we had to pay for it. But what was extremely helpful through the relationship with Don was the access to the artists and the access to be able to shoot the session. You know, we begin the film with a session with the young artists.
The Blue Note All-Stars, as you call them. I love that.
Yeah. And that was sort of another goal of mine, to kind of provide a look behind the scenes, you know, to really be in that studio, whether it's through the photographs in the past or now when we film them, you know, playing Robert Glasper's song. That's how it starts.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the middle, when Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter join the young guys, and that's actually something that came about through the film, because it was just going to be the all-stars, the younger guys. And I saw that Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter were playing in L.A. at the same time. So I asked Don, would he consider inviting them to the session? And that's how that happened.
So were they, did it take coaxing, or were they like ready to jump right on board because of their early part in the history of Blue Note?
They've played with some of the artists in of the All-Stars. I think they never played all together, but like Herbie had played with Robert and some of the other guys. And Lionel, the guitarist, always tours with Herbie Hancock. So, you know, they all knew each other, and Herbie is actually not on the label anymore, but Wayne Shorter is. And Herbie Hancock also wanted to participate, because it was not long after Bruce Lundvall had died. And it's just been, you know, they both had their made their debuts on Blue Note, which is another reason why this label is different in the history of music, because they gave so many people the first chance.
80 years.
You know, Monk, Bud Powell,
right.
Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter.
1939 to 2019, 80 years Blue Note has been around and has introduced the world to so many, many artists. Thelonious Monk, one of the most experimental, adventurous musicians of his era and probably still today. We're going to give you a three-minute clip right now of one of the most famous songs perhaps he and other jazz players are known for. In fact, it was the title track of a Dexter Gordon film, Around Midnight.
I love that one.
We're going to give you this, and then Sophie will be back on the other side. Timeless and influential jazz songs of the 20th century. Thelonious Monk, Round Midnight. Just a short clip there, 3 minutes 12 seconds, but boy, does it say a lot. We are speaking today with Sophie Huber. She's calling in from Switzerland. She is the director behind Blue Note Records, Beyond the Notes. It has been screened in various theaters, but now it's coming out for you to own on DVD, Blu-ray, digital formats, and it's all happening on September 6th, so it's just around the corner. And again, this is a historical piece, but it's not dry and boring. It's full of art and color and history, and it's, as they would say in the book world, it's a page-turner. You don't want to stop it or pause it. And again, Sophie, your vision in creating this is so unique. You had a topic that could have been dismissed, as you said, the J word. A lot of people have this connotation of that jazz is dry and boring and for the elite. But you have made it a very common music, and you even underscore that by comparing it to the hip-hop world. And they talked about one of the young directors or producers of the hip-hop sound had said that jazz was like hip-hop and that it was the music of the street. It was the music of what they lived. All the jazz was so different because it was of the life they lived. And, of course, being African-Americans at that time in history, they had a lot of turmoil going on. So the music reflected that. And it's the same thing in hip-hop today. And we've seen artists like A Tribe Called Quest, Cypress Hill, and others that have sampled jazz. We always hear of them sampling funk and James Brown and things like that. But those were artists that actually sampled the jazz masters, and you bring that all full circle in this documentary.
Thank you. Yeah, he came through the musicians, you know, because Terrace Martin, who's in the film, who is a musician, but he's also the producer on some of the Kendrick Lamar albums, like To Pimp a Butterfly, and who brought the jazz musicians to the project. You know, he, for example, says that he learned so much from Thelonious Monk, and that it's the same as hip hop in the sense that that you express whatever there is, and you don't care what the next man thinks, in his word, you know.
Right.
And when I was just listening, what you played, first of all, I envy that you can play full take, which unfortunately, you know, you can't really do in a film. I mean, you could, but then it's 80 years long.
Then it's a miniseries.
Yeah. But to hear how he plays and how it's almost like he's discovering each note as he plays it, which makes it so unpredictable and exciting and bold, you know, which at that time a lot of people didn't like that because of that.
Right. It was hard to understand. I think it was Alfred Lion that said, "I don't understand it, but I like it."
Yeah.
I think that kind of summed up jazz in general. You don't have to understand it. I mean, it's music. If you enjoy it, it's good.
Yeah, and you just feel it, you know.
What did you learn in the making of this? Obviously, growing up in Switzerland, you mentioned that you had gone to jazz festivals and you knew jazz, but what was the biggest thing you, as a filmmaker, working with these artists, working with this topic, discovered?
Well, it was, let's say, what like inspired me most is the level of commitment and dedication and curiosity and humanity that the musicians bring to the table. And that's not just like sitting across from Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter, who are just exceptional people who are so present. And I think it comes from improvising and that the way they play, that they have to be so open and pick up whatever is, you know, happening at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
That reflects on their lives and on them as human beings, and that's just something that's extremely exciting to be around. And also, but the same with the young guys too. Their eloquence, their passion for what they do. Again, that it's not about the money, but for a more meaningful pursuit, you know, to sense that quest, that curiosity, and that passion that I feel, you know, we should all have, whether we're artists or whatever we do.
Agreed. I was shocked I still can't wrap my head around Don Was being president of Blue Note, because I mean, I'm familiar with him from Walk the Dinosaur and all the pop kind of stuff he's done. When I saw him on, I thought, oh, Don's on here. And then I realized, I see the type under president of Blue Note. He's only been that, what, 6-7 years now?
Yeah, I think since 2012. Yeah, so 7 years.
What direction Has he taken it? We mentioned Nora Jones, and there's a few contemporary artists that are now signed. I don't want to say smooth jazz because that is not what Blue Note's about, but experimental in a way that are contemporary still. What has Don brought to the history of Blue Note that's taken it into the next chapter, as far as you as an observer have seen?
Yeah. You know, he had in his office that when Alfred Lion and Frank Wolf started the label in 1939, they wrote a manifesto saying that this is not for, you know, commercial goals, but to capture uncompromising expressions and to let the artist do what they want to do to reflect their times. So I think Don takes that to heart and really lets the artists do what they want to do.
Okay.
He didn't sign Nora Jones. She was actually signed by Bruce Lundwall in 2002 or something. But there's a new, for example, vibraphonist, Joel Roth. He's not in the film because he was signed later when we were already finished. But he's very exciting. There's a lot of young artists that are just, you know, really bold, and that's something that I discovered too when I started working on this. I didn't know the young guys, but because I wanted to feature them, obviously, I started, you know, finding out about all these names. I start going to jazz concerts and hear them play, which is, I think, the way you really get the whole essence of the music, you know, when you actually see it live.
Robert Glasper, in particular, impressed me watching. I'd never heard of him prior to watching your documentary. And the way they approach the sessions, when you're filming that session, even though it's only a few minutes on the film, you can see that they are working in the old school tradition. You know, they're just like picking up and playing. You can see in their face that they're feeling it independently, but somehow it's colliding together into this beautiful piece of music. And it sounds brilliant. And then he goes, let's try that again. You know, and it's like, and it changes a little bit. I just think the fact that in a world where music is so programmed and, you know, and then tunings and all the other things that are out there making it so commercial and that anyone can make music, you have found some true musical geniuses of a new generation, and seeing them follow the template that the masters have laid down, it gives you reassurance that jazz is in good hands.
Yeah, and that's something that Don has a lot to do with as well. I mean, to try to create a atmosphere that just helps the artist, you know, just by trying to make it as relaxed as possible and just let them do what they need to do.
Who would you say?
And that was beautiful in that session that, yeah, they record in one room, you know, it's not everyone in their own box. And it's really what you hear on the record is what happened. And we, you know, the Mascalero, the piece that Wayne Shorter wrote that's in the middle of the film, where Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock and the young guys come together. They did two takes. They, you know, played it from beginning to end. Obviously, each one was about 9-10 minutes. And they were completely different. And nobody knows how to start or, you know, what will happen. And it's just extremely exciting. That's what that music is.
Yeah, again, it just shows you that things are still moving forward in a very positive way, and that what's old is new, and what's new is you know, not necessarily old. One of the things that stood out, too, is the fact that you had access, and I don't know if he's still living or if these were archival films, but Rudy Van Gelder, the recording engineer that worked under Alfred and Francis, is he still with us, or was that new footage?
We filmed that interview, I believe, in 2015, and he died either in 2016 or 2017.
Thank goodness you were able to capture that.
That was one of his last interviews.
That really brings it home because he was there in the thick of it. And having him really, really brings it home as to how it was back then.
Yeah, and it was amazing to be in that studio, you know, where we interviewed him, mm-hmm. is where he had recorded everything that he didn't record in his parents' living room before that.
Right. Who would you say, and we're going to let you go here in just a second, but who would you say are your favorite artists at this moment from Blue Note? Who are your favorites?
Well, Monk, just because he immediately moves me. You know, even just listening to Round Midnight, it just affects me right away. I love Bud Powell. Like each time, you know, I've seen the film 500 times, but each time when I chose Un Poco Loco in the film,
mm-hmm.
each time that comes on, it just energizes me. And I guess I loved them also both because they were sort of difficult characters, but you just sense a sensibility or something just a little different. But then there's also, you know, like Ambrose Akinmuziri, the trumpeter is really outstanding, the one of the younger guys.
Right.
All of them really, because, you know, I've been following them and, yeah.
It's been the soundtrack of your life for the last 5 years.
Yes.
What's next for you, Sophie? I mean, you've got this amazing film under your belt. It's now coming out for the public. It's a done project other than doing a little promotion behind it. What is your next project as a filmmaker?
I'm actually doing a lot of promotion. No, because somebody has to do it. You know, we don't have money for radio ads or billboards or all
right.
of that. So I haven't really fully had time to think about it, but I will in the coming months. I'd love to do something fictional that I can research like a documentary.
Okay.
It might be in the woods of Tennessee, but that's about all I know.
Okay. Well, hopefully you'll make it to Chicago. I would love to see you take on the Chicago blues scene. There's been a lot of documentaries on Chicago blues, but again, they're kind of dry in historical perspective. You bring a vibrancy with your filmmaking. Mm. And I think to see you take on Chess Records and, you know, the Muddy Waters, the Howlin' Wolves, as much as the rock influences of blues like Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, to see what you could come up with by putting that world in your lens. I would love that, and I hope maybe someday you can do that for the history of Chicago blues.
Well, thank you. That will make me think now.
Good. And when you film it, I want to be there.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, if the film comes to Chicago, I'll definitely let you know.
Okay, very good. We're going to leave you with something a little newer from Blue Note as we say goodbye to Sophie. We were talking about Nora Jones, and this is Nora taking on what I believe is an old Hank Williams Sr. song, Cold, Cold Heart. Thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate it, and I love public radio.
Thank you. We love you back.
Good.
DVD, Blu-ray, digital, global, it's all here September 6th. Blue Note Records, Beyond the Notes. And here is Nora Jones. Stay with us. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll have some live blues with the Stoney Curtis Band in studio. Bye-bye.
It's just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? Another love before my time made your heart sad and blue. And so my heart is paying now things I didn't do. In anger, unkind words I said that make the teardrops start. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? that you belong to me. But now I know your heart is shackled to a memory. The more I learn to care for you, the more we drift apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold?